Chapter 13. Part of the post office was still standing. The rest had collapsed and burned. There were crowds everywhere. Graber had to wait for a while. Then he got window 15 and showed the slip of paper with the message that had been written on it. The clerk handed the slip back to him. "Have you means of identification?" Graber pushed his paybook and his furlough certificate through the grating. The clerk studied them. "What is it?" Graber asked. "A message?" The clerk made no reply. He got up and disappeared in the background. Graber waited, staring at his papers lying open on the counter. The clerk came back with a small battered package in his hand. Once more he compared the address with the one on Graber's furlough certificate. Then he pushed the package through the window.
"Sign here."
Graber saw his mother's handwriting on the package. She had sent it to him at the front, and it had been forwarded from there. He looked for the sender's address. It was still Hockenstrasse. He took the package and signed the receipt. "Is that all there was?" he asked. The clerk glanced up.
"Do you think we are withholding something?"
"Not that. I thought perhaps you might have gotten my parents' new address."
"We're not responsible for that here. Ask on the second floor in the delivery section."
Graber went up. The second floor was only half roofed over. Over the remainder, one could see the sky with clouds and sun.
"We've no new address here," said the woman who sat behind the window. "Otherwise, we would not have sent the package to Hockenstrasse. But you can always ask the letter carrier from your district."
"Where is he?" The woman looked at her watch.
"He's on his rounds now. If you come back this afternoon about 4, he'll be here. That's when the mail is distributed."
"Could he possibly know the address when you don't know it here?"
"Of course not. He only gets the addresses from us. But there are people who like to ask him just the same. It reassures them. That's the way people are, or aren't they?"
"Yes, probably." Graber took his package and went down the stairs. He looked at the date. It had been sent 3 weeks before and had taken a long time to reach the front, but from there, it had got back quickly. He stood in a corner and opened the brown paper. A dry cake lay inside, a pair of woolen socks, a package of cigarettes, and a letter from his mother. He read the letter. There was nothing in it about a change of address or about air raids. He put it in his pocket and waited until he was calm again. Then he went out into the street. He told himself that now, surely, he would soon get a letter with a new address. Nevertheless, he felt more miserable than he had expected. He decided to go and see Binding. Perhaps he would have some news.
"Come in, Ernst," Alphonse called. "We're busy emptying a bottle. You can help us."
Binding was not alone. An SS man was half lying on the big sofa under the Rubens, as though he had fallen there and could not immediately get up again. He was a thin fellow with a sallow face and hair so extremely blonde that he looked as though he had neither eyelashes nor brows.
"That is Heine,"
Alphonse said with a certain measure of respect.
"Heine, the snake charmer! And this is my friend Ernst, on furlough from Russia."
Heine was fairly drunk. He had very pale eyes and a small mouth.
"Russia,"
he muttered.
"I was there too. Fine times. Better than here."
Graber looked at Binding questioningly.
"Heine is already one bottle ahead,"
Alphonse explained.
"He has trouble. His parents' home was bombed. Nothing happened to the family. They were all in the cellar, but the house is wrecked."
"4 rooms,"
Heine growled.
"All new furniture. The piano, too. Wonderful piano. Beautiful tone. Those swine."
"Heine will get even for that piano,"
Alphonse said.
"Come, Ernst. What will you have to drink?"
"Heine's drinking cognac. There's vodka and kümmel here, too. Or anything else you want."
"Nothing at all. I just stopped in for a moment to ask whether you found out anything."
"Nothing new yet, Ernst. Your parents are no longer in this district. At least they have not been reported anywhere, nor in the villages. Either they have moved away and haven't reported yet, or they've been sent on with the other evacuees. You know how it is nowadays. The whole country is being bombed by those swine."
and so it takes a while for communications to be restored. Come along, have something to drink. You can risk one glass, can't you?
All right, some vodka.
Vodka, Heine muttered. We swilled it in rivers, and then poured it down the beasts' throats and lit it. Made flamethrowers out of them. Children, how they hopped around. You'd die laughing. Fine times then in Russia.
What? Graber asked. Heine did not reply. He was staring glassily straight ahead.
Flamethrowers, he muttered. Magnificent idea.
What's he talking about? Graber asked, bending. Alphonse shrugged his shoulders.
Heine had a hand in all sorts of things. He was with the SD.
With the SD in Russia?
Yes. Have another drink, Ernst.
Graber picked up the bottle from the copper's smoking stand and looked at it. The clear liquor swished back and forth.
What proof is vodka?
Alphonse laughed.
It's pretty strong. Sure to be 120 proof. The Ivans can take it strong.
They can take it strong, Graber thought. And if it's as strong as that, then it will burn if someone pours it down your throat and lights it. He looked at Heine. He had heard enough stories about the security service of the SS to know that what Heine was saying in his drunkenness was no exaggeration. The SD, under pretext of providing Lebensraum for the German people, carried on liquidations in the grand style and by the thousands. They liquidated everything they considered undesirable, and to keep the mass killings from becoming monotonous, the SS invented humorous variations. Graber knew about some of them. Others had been told him by Steinbrenner. Living flamethrowers were new.
Why are you staring at the bottle? Alphonse asked. It won't bite you. Fill your glass.
Graber put the bottle back. He wanted to get up and go away, but he remained seated. He forced himself to remain seated. He had gone away often enough and refused to know. He and 100,000 others. And they had thought, in that way, they could quiet their consciences. He no longer wanted that. He no longer wanted to evade. He had not come back on furlough for that purpose.
Won't you change your mind and have one more?
Alphonse asked. Graber looked at Heine, who was half asleep.
Is he still with the SD? No longer. He's here now.
Where?
He's a commander in the concentration camp.
The concentration camp?
Yes. Have another swallow, Ernst. We'll not be as young when we meet again. And stay a while longer. Don't always run off right away.
No, Graber said, continuing to stare at Heine. I'll not run off anymore.
At last, you're talking sense. What will you have to drink? Another vodka?
No. Give me Kuml or cognac. No vodka. Heine roused himself. Of course, no vodka, he mumbled. Much too wasteful. We lapped up the vodka ourselves. It was gasoline. Gasoline burns better.
Heine was vomiting in the bathroom.
Alphonse was standing with Graber in front of the door. The sky was filled with fleecy white clouds. In the birch trees, a blackbird was singing, a little black ball with a yellow beak in whose voice was all of spring.
Mad fellow, that Heine, eh?
Alphonse said. He said it like a boy talking about a bloodthirsty Indian chief, with a mixture of horror and admiration. He's a mad fellow with people who can't defend themselves, Graber replied.
He has a stiff arm, Ernst. That's why he can't be in the regular army. Got it in a beer hall brawl with the communists in 1932. It's what makes him so wild, too. Man, that was quite a story about the pyre of wood, wasn't it?
Alphonse puffed at a dead cigar he had lighted while Heine was recounting his further Russian exploits. In his excitement, he had let it go out.
First a layer of wood, and then a layer of people, and each layer having to haul its own wood and then lie down on it and be shot in the back of the head. That's something, eh?
Yes, that's something.
And the women! Can you imagine what went on with them?
Yes, well enough. Would you like to have been there?
With the women?
No, with the others.
at the burning pyre and the Christmas trees covered with hanged men and the mass machine gunnings.
Binding reflected for a moment. Then he shook his head.
I don't think so. Perhaps once, just to have seen it. Otherwise, I'm not the type for it. Too romantic, Ernst.
Heine appeared in the doorway. He was very pale.
Duty! He growled. Late already. Time to get going. Now twist the swine's snouts for this.
He stamped down the garden path. At the gate, he straightened his cap, threw back his shoulders, and strode on like a stork.
I wouldn't like to be the next prisoner to fall into his hands, Alphonse said.
Graber glanced up.
He had been thinking the same thing. Do you think that's right, Alphonse?
He asked. Binding shrugged his shoulders.
They're all traitors to the nation, Ernst. They're not there for nothing.
Was Burmeister a traitor to the nation?
Alphonse laughed. That was a private matter. Besides, nothing much happened to him.
And if something had happened to him?
Then that would have been his bad luck, Ernst. Lots of people have had bad luck these days. From bombs, for example. 5,000 in this city alone. Better people than those in the concentration camp. So what does it matter to me what happens there? It's not my responsibility. Not yours.
A couple of sparrows flew twittering to the bird bath in the middle of the lawn. One of them waded in and began to beat his wings, and all at once they were all in the bath, splashing about. Alphonse was watching them intently. He seemed to have forgotten Heine already. Graber looked at the satisfied, harmless face, and with sudden shock he realized the eternal hopelessness to which justice and sympathy are condemned, always to suffer shipwreck on egoism and indifference and fear. He realized it, and he realized, too, that he himself was not exempt, that he, too, was caught in it, in an anonymous, indirect, and sinister fashion, as though he and Binding somehow belonged together, however much he might struggle against it. This business of responsibility isn't as simple as all that, Alphonse, he said somberly.
But, Ernst, don't be funny! You can only be held responsible for what you yourself do, and then only when you're not acting on orders.
When we shoot hostages, we say exactly the opposite, that they are responsible for what others have done.
Have you shot hostages?
Binding asked, turning around with interest. Graber made no reply.
Hostage is something else again, Ernst. They are exceptions, necessary exceptions.
Everything's a necessary exception, Graber declared bitterly. Everything that one does oneself, I mean. Of course not what the others do. When we bomb a city, that's a strategic necessity. When the others do it, it's a hideous crime.
That's what it is. At last you're thinking sensibly.
Alphonse looked at Graber and grinned slyly from the side.
That's what's called modern politics. The right is what is useful to the German people, as our Minister of Justice has said. And after all, he must know. We only do our duty. We are not responsible.
He bent forward.
There's the blackbird. Do you see him? The first time he's taken a bath. How the sparrows clear out.
Graber suddenly saw Heine in front of him. The street was empty. Between the garden hedges lay dull sunlight. A yellow butterfly floated low over the strips of sand that bordered the cement sidewalk, and about 100 yards ahead, Heine swung around the corner. Graber walked on the sand. It was very quiet, and his footsteps were inaudible. He looked around. If anyone wanted to get rid of Heine, this was the right time. There was no one in sight. The street seemed asleep. You could approach almost noiselessly on the strip of sand. Heine would not notice anything. You could strike him down and strangle him or stab him. A shot would make too much noise and attract people too quickly. Heine was not very powerful. You could strangle him. Graber noticed that he was walking faster. Alphonse would not suspect him, he thought. He would believe that someone had taken revenge on Heine. There were certainly plenty of grounds for that. It was a splendid opportunity for someone to take revenge, and it was an opportunity, too, to rid the world of a murderer who in an hour's time would in all likelihood be torturing to death some terrified, defenseless human being. Graber felt his hands sweating. Suddenly he was very hot. He came to the corner and saw that he had gained about 30 yards on Heine.
There was still no one in sight. If he ran quickly along the strip of sand, everything would be over in less than a minute. He could stab Heine and run on instantly. All at once, his heart was beating like a hammer. It seemed to beat so loud that for a moment he feared Heine might hear it. "What's the matter with me?" he thought. "What concern is this of mine? How have I gotten involved in it?" The idea that a moment before had been fortuitous had now suddenly transformed itself into a dark compulsion. It seemed to fill up all his mind. It was as though he had to do it, as though everything depended on his doing it, as though it were a justification for many things in the past, for his own life, for things in it that he wanted to forget, and for things he had done and things he had left undone. Vengeance, he thought in confusion. But it was someone he hardly knew, someone who had done nothing to him. Nor did he have any cause for vengeance. Not yet, he thought. But was it not possible that Elisabeth's father was already among Heine's victims? Or might he not belong to their number today, or tomorrow? And whom had the hostages harmed, or the countless innocents? And where was the guilt for that, and where the atonement? He stared at Heine's back. His mouth was dry. A dog barked from a garden gate. He started and looked around. I've had too much to drink, he thought. I must stop. All this has nothing to do with me. It's crazy. But he went on faster, silently, driven by something incomprehensible, something that seemed a compensation and a justification for all the death that lay behind him. He had approached within 20 yards without knowing what he was going to do. Then, at the end of the street, he saw a woman coming out of an opening in the hedge. She was wearing an orange blouse and carrying a basket, and she was coming toward him. He went slack. Everything in him relaxed. He almost stopped, and then went on very slowly. The woman swung her basket and walked at an easy pace past Heine and toward Graeber. She advanced with quiet strides. She had strong, broad breasts, a broad, tanned face, and smooth, dark hair parted in the middle. The sky behind her head was pale, flickering, and unclear. She alone was clear. Everything else swam together. She alone was real. She was life. She bore it on her broad shoulders. She brought it with her, and it was great and good. And behind her were wilderness and murder. She looked at him as she passed. Good day, she said in a friendly tone. Graeber nodded. He could not speak. He heard her steps behind him, and the wilderness was there again, flickering. And amid the flickering, he saw Heine's dark figure move around the next corner, and the street was free. He looked around. The woman was walking on, calm and unconcerned. Why don't I run? He thought. I still have time to do it. But he already knew he would not do it. Something had broken. I can't do it now, he thought. The woman saw me. She would recognize me again. But would he have done it if the woman had not come? Would he not have found some other excuse? He did not know. He came to the crossing where Heine had turned. Heine was not in sight. He saw him again at the next corner. He was standing in the middle of the street. An SS man was talking to him and then walked on with him. A mailman was coming out of a gateway. A little farther on, two men with bicycles stood talking together. It was past. Graeber felt as if he had suddenly awakened. He looked around. What had that been? He thought. Damn it, I was close to doing it. How did it happen? What's the matter with me? What was it that suddenly burst out of me? He walked on. I must keep watch on myself, he thought. I believed I was calm. I am not calm. I am more confused than I realize. I must keep watch on myself or I'll commit some damn foolishness. At a newsstand, he bought a paper and stood there reading the war news. He had not done this until now. He had not wanted to be reminded of it. Now he read, and he saw that the retreat had continued. On the small inset map, he found the approximate place where his regiment must be. He could not determine it exactly. The war news only reported army groups, but he could estimate that they had retreated about 100 kilometers farther. He stood very still for a while. For the whole time that he had been on leave, he had not once thought of his comrades. Memory had fallen from him like a stone. Now it came back. It seemed to him as though a gray loneliness rose from the ground. It was noiseless. The war news had reported heavy fighting in Graber's section. But the gray loneliness was noiseless and colorless, as though the light and even the protest of battle had long since died in it. Shadows arose, bloodless and empty. They moved and looked at him and through him, and when they fell, they were like the gray uptorn ground, and the ground was like them, as though it were moving and growing into them. The high gleaming sky above him seemed for a moment to lose its color before the gray smoke of this endless dying, which seemed to rise up out of the earth and throw an overcast across the sun. Betrayed, he thought bitterly. They have been betrayed. Betrayed and befouled. Their fighting and their dying have been coupled with murder and injustice and lies and might. They have been defrauded, defrauded of everything, even of their miserable, courageous, pitiful and useless deaths. A woman carrying a bag in front of her collided with him.
Can't you use your eyes? She snapped irritably.
I can, Graber said without moving.
Then why don't you get out of my way?
Graber did not answer. He suddenly knew why he had followed Heine. It was the darkness that he had so often felt in the field. The question he had never dared to answer, the pressing despair he had evaded again and again. It had finally caught up with him and brought him to bay. And he knew now what it was, and he no longer wanted to evade it. He wanted clarity. He was ready for it. Pohlmann, he thought. Freisenburg wanted me to go and see him. I had forgotten. I will go and talk to him. I have to talk to someone I can trust.
Blockhead,
said the heavily laden woman, and dragged herself on. Half of the Jahnplatz had been destroyed. The other half stood undamaged. Only a few of the windows were broken. The daily round went on there, with women cleaning and cooking, while opposite, the house fronts had collapsed, revealing only fragmentary rooms where torn carpets hung down like slashed flags after a lost battle. The house where Pohlmann had lived was on the ruined side. The upper floors had fallen in, burying the entrance. It looked as though no one could still be living there. Graber was on the point of giving up when he discovered beside the house a narrow, trodden path through the rubble. He followed it and found a passage shoveled out to the undamaged back door. He knocked. No one answered. He knocked again. After a while, he heard sounds. A chain rattled and the door was cautiously opened. Herr Pohlmann, Graber said. An old man peered out.
Yes? What do you want?
I'm Ernst Graber, a former pupil of yours.
Ah, yes. And what would you like?
To call on you. I'm here on furlough.
I no longer hold a teaching post, Pohlmann said shortly.
I know that.
All right. Then you know, too, that I was dismissed for disciplinary reasons. I no longer receive students and, in point of fact, do not have the right to do so.
I am no longer a student. I am a soldier and I have come from Russia. And I bring you greetings from Freisenburg. He told me to come and see you. The old man regarded Graber more attentively.
Freisenburg? Is he still alive?
10 days ago, he was still alive. Pohlmann continued to regard Graber for a moment.
All right, come in,
he said then, stepping back. Graber followed him. They went along a corridor that led to a kind of kitchen, and from there, through a second short passage. Pohlmann suddenly walked faster, opened a door, and said much louder than before,
Come in here! I thought at first you were from the police.
Graber looked at him in surprise. Then he understood. He did not look around. Probably Pohlmann had spoken so loud in order to reassure someone. The room was lighted by a small oil lamp with a green shade. The windows were broken, and outside the rubble was piled so high one could not see out. Pohlmann paused in the middle of the room.
Now I recognize you, he said. Outside, the light was too strong. I don't go out much, and I am no longer used to it. Here I have no daylight, only the oil, and there's not much of that. As a result, I often sit for a long time in the dark. The electric light connections have been broken.
Graber looked at him. He would not have recognized him. He had grown so old. Then he glanced around, and it seemed to him as though he had come into another world. It was not only the stillness in the unexpected lamp-lit room that was like a catacomb after the harsh noonday sun. It was something else besides. It was the rows of brown and gold books on the walls. It was the reading desk. It was the steel engravings of Weimar. And it was the old man with the white hair and furrowed face, which seemed in its waxen pallor like that of a man who had been imprisoned for years. Pohlmann noticed Graeber's glance.
I have been fortunate, he said. I have been able to save almost all my books.
Graeber turned around.
I haven't seen any in a long time, and in the last few years I've read very little. Probably you couldn't. Books are too heavy to cart around with you in a knapsack.
They were also too heavy to cart around with you in your head. They did not go very well with what was happening, and the ones that did go well with it were the ones you didn't want to read. Pohlmann gazed into the soft green light of the lamp.
Why did you come to see me, Graeber?
Friesenburg told me I ought to.
Do you know him well?
He was the only human being out there I trusted completely. He said I should come here and talk to you. You would tell me the truth. Graeber looked at the old man. It seemed infinitely long ago that he had been in his class. Nevertheless, for the span of a heartbeat, he suddenly had the feeling that he was once again a student facing an examination about his life, and as if in this little half-buried room, with all the books and the discredited teacher of his youth, his fate was now to be decided. Here was embodied the past that had once been. Kindness, tolerance, and knowledge. And the rubble outside the windows was what the present had made out of it. I would like to know how far I am involved in the crimes of the last 10 years, he said. And I would like to know what I ought to do. Pohlmann stared at him. Then he got up and walked across the room. He took a book from the shelves, opened it, put it back without looking at it. Finally, he turned around.
Do you know what you are asking?
Yes.
People are beheaded for less than that nowadays.
At the front, people are killed for nothing, Graeber said. Pohlmann came back and sat down again.
By crime, do you mean the war?
I mean everything that led up to it. The lies, the oppression, the injustice, the use of force. And I mean the war. The war and the way we wage it, with slave camps, concentration camps, and the mass murder of civilians. Pohlmann was silent.
I have seen certain things, Graeber said, and I have heard a good deal. I know, too, that the war is lost. And I know that we are only continuing to fight so that the government, the party, and the people who caused it all can stay in power for a while longer and create still more misery.
Pohlmann stared at Graeber again.
You know all that?
He asked. I know it now. I've not always known it.
And you have to go out again?
Yes.
That's dreadful.
It's even more dreadful to have to go out again knowing this, and thereby perhaps to become an accomplice.
Will I be that?
Pohlmann was silent.
How do you mean?
He asked after a while, almost in a whisper. You know what I mean. You instructed us in religion. How far shall I be an accomplice if I know not only that the war is lost, but also that we have to lose it, so that slavery, murder, concentration camps, SS and SD, mass exterminations, and inhumanity shall cease. If I know that, and in 2 weeks I have to go out and fight for it again?
Pohlmann's face was suddenly gray and extinguished. Only his eyes still had color, a strange clear blue. They reminded Graeber of eyes he had seen somewhere before, but he did not remember where.
Must you go out again?
Pohlmann asked finally.
I could refuse, then I would be hanged or shot. Or I could desert, then I would pretty certainly be caught in a short time. You can depend for that on the organization and the informers. And where could I hide? Anyone who gave me shelter would be risking death himself.
Besides that, they would take revenge on my parents. The least would be a concentration camp for them. They would die there. What else can I do? Go back to the front and do nothing to defend myself? That would be suicide.
A clock began to strike. Graber had not seen it before. It was an old grandfather clock in a corner behind the door. Its deep note was suddenly a ghostly indication of time in the quiet, buried room.
And there is nothing besides? Pullman asked.
There's self-mutilation. It's almost always discovered. The punishment is the same as for desertion.
Couldn't you be transferred? Back home?
No, I am very healthy and strong. And I think, too, it would not do much to answer my question. It would be an escape, but hardly a solution. One can be an accomplice in an office, too, don't you think?
Yes.
Pullman pressed his hands together.
Guilt, he then said softly. No one knows where it begins and where it ends. If you like, it begins everywhere and ends nowhere, but perhaps is just the other way about. And complicity. Who knows about that? Only God.
Graber made an impatient gesture. God should indeed know about it, he replied. Otherwise, there would be no original sin. That is complicity extending over thousands of generations. But where does personal responsibility begin? We cannot simply take refuge behind the fact that we were acting on orders. Or can we?
It is compulsion, not just orders.
Graber waited.
The martyrs in Christian times did not submit to compulsion,
Pullman said hesitantly.
We are no martyrs. But where does complicity begin?
Graber asked.
When does what is ordinarily called heroism become murder? When you no longer believe in the reason for it, or in its aim? Where's the dividing line?
Pullman looked at Graber tormentedly.
How can I tell you that? It is too great a responsibility.
I cannot decide that for you. Must each one decide for himself?
I believe so. What else?
Graber was silent.
Why do I go on questioning? He thought. I am suddenly sitting here like a judge instead of one accused. Why do I torment this old man and call him to account for the things he once taught me and for the things I have learned later without him? Do I still need an answer? Haven't I already answered myself?
He looked at Pullman.
He could picture how day after day he crouched in this room, in the darkness or beside the lamp, as though in a catacomb of ancient Rome, dismissed from his position, in hourly expectation of arrest, laboriously seeking comfort in his books. You're right, he said. To ask someone else always means an attempt to evade a decision. Besides, I didn't really expect an answer from you. I was really only questioning myself. Sometimes you can't do that except by putting the question to someone else.
Pullman shook his head.
You have the right to ask.
Complicity, he said with sudden vehemence. What do you know of that? You were young and they poisoned you with lies before you had learned to judge. But we saw it and let it happen. What caused it? Hardness of heart? Indifference? Poverty? Egoism? Despair? And how could it become such a plague? Do you suppose that I don't think about it every day?
Graber suddenly knew what Pullman's eyes reminded him of. It was the eyes of the Russian at whom he had shot. He got up.
I must go, he said. Thanks for letting me in and talking to me.
He took his cap. Pullman roused himself.
What do you intend to do, Graber?
I don't know. I still have 2 weeks' time to think it over. That's a lot when you're used to living from minute to minute.
Come again. Come once more before you leave. Promise me to.
I promise.
Not many come,
Pullman murmured.
Graber saw a small photograph standing between the books near the rubble-blocked windows. It was a man of his own age in uniform. He remembered that Pullman had had a son.
but in these times it was better not to ask questions about such matters.
Send my regards to Freisenburg if you write to him,
Pullman said.
Yes. Did you talk to him the way you have just been talking to me?
Yes.
I wish you had talked to me that way before.
Do you think it made things easier for Freisenburg?
No, Graeber said. Harder. Pullman nodded.
I couldn't tell you anything. But I didn't want to give you any of the many answers that are nothing but excuses. There are plenty of them, all smooth and persuasive, and all evasions.
Those of the church, too?
Pullman hesitated an instant.
Those of the church, too,
he said then.
But the church is lucky. Over against love thy neighbor and thou shalt not kill, there conveniently stands that other saying, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Given that, a good pulpit acrobat can perform all sorts of feats.
Graeber smiled. He recognized something of the sarcasm that Pullman had formerly had. Pullman saw him.
You're smiling, he said. And you are so calm. Why aren't you screaming?
I am screaming, Graeber replied. You just don't hear it.
He was standing in front of the door. Bright spears of sunlight assailed his eyes. The white mortar flickered. Slowly he walked across the square. He had the feeling of someone who, after a long, uncertain trial, has finally received judgment, and to whom it is almost a matter of indifference whether it is acquittal or not. It was over. He had wanted it. It was the thing he had planned to think about during his vacation, and now he knew what it was. It was despair, and he no longer drew back from it. For a while he sat on a bench that had remained standing close to the edge of a bomb crater. He was completely relaxed and empty, and could not have said whether he was disconsolate or not. He just did not want to think any more. There was nothing more to think about. He leaned his head back and closed his eyes and felt the sun warm on his face. He felt nothing else. He sat still there, breathing quietly, and felt the impersonal, comforting warmth, which knew neither justice nor injustice. After a while, he opened his eyes. The square lay before him very clear and distinct. He saw a large linden tree that stood in front of a demolished house. It was unharmed and thrust its trunk and branches up out of the earth like a giant, wide-open hand, touched with green, straining upward toward the light and the bright clouds. The sky behind the clouds was very blue. Everything gleamed and shimmered as though after a rain. It had depth and power. It was life. Strong, open life. Self-evident, without questions, without sorrow, without despair. Graeber felt it as though he were emerging from a nightmare. It burst full upon him, and everything melted into it. It was a wordless answer beyond all questions, beyond all thought, an answer that he knew from the nights and days when death had brushed him, and when, out of spasm, rigidity, and finality, life had suddenly rushed back into him, a hot and rescuing drive that blotted out the brain in its surge. He got up and went past the linden tree, between the ruins and the houses. He felt suddenly that he was waiting. Everything in him was waiting. He was waiting for the evening, as though for an armistice.